Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to this month's Chemistry World Podcast with Mark Peplow, Victoria Gill, James Mitchell Crowe, and I'm Chris Smith. Coming up, where the drink that turns white when you add water to it might be just the kind of tonic that the pharmaceutical sector is looking for.
What the team think is that if they can figure out the secret to this sort of super stable pastis emulsion, they'll be able to use it to form nanocapsules to encapsulate drugs for drug delivery, for example, because this is obviously a really energy efficient form of making oil droplets.
More from Victoria on the science of ouzo on the way, when we'll also be meeting the robot with a taste for Arabica.
Researchers at Nestlé in Lausanne in Switzerland have basically developed a machine that can accurately tell you what a coffee tastes like.
Sounds like the kind of caffeine-fueled job I'd like. And on the subject of addictive substances, we'll also be looking at the problem of opium in Afghanistan. This, of course, turns the opium into heroin, which then reaches the streets of Europe. But the chemical culprits are getting much harder to catch.
Previously, there were fairly large and fairly static labs, usually around the tribal areas abutting Pakistan, that would convert this opium into heroin. We're now seeing a high prevalence of mobile labs that enable conversion at a more local level within the country.
More from Paul Burton at the Senlis Council on the way. They're proposing that we should buy the opium off the farmers so that it can be used legitimately. But as we'll be hearing, the United Nations have every reason to think that's a bad idea. Plus, in the future, if you think the music on your iPod sounds pants, there might be a good reason.
Your iPod could one day be powered by your trousers. So it's literally when these crystals get bent or twisted, they generate a current, a very small current. But if you have enough of these, then you could potentially get enough power to run something like a mobile phone or an iPod.
Sounds good. And also on the way is the solution to last month's chemical conundrum.
What makes safety matches safe?
So if you were struck by the answer and you sent it in to us, then you could be a winner. We'll be giving you the correct explanation and the names of the winning entries later in the programme.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Now, some people love the stuff, but others can't stand it, and I think I'm probably among them. But the science of the famous aniseedy drinks like ouzo, pernod, pastis and raki that turn white when you add water to them is fascinating. But it's also got chemists confused, Victoria.
Yeah, this seems to be baffling chemists. It's quite surprising in that all the state-of-the-art chemistry that we have, and pernod seems to be defying theoretical chemistry. This comes out of a research institute in the Netherlands. The lead researcher is now based at MIT in the US. And she has measured the tension between the bubbles that form in the emulsion in pernod. Pernod being this oil-based aniseed drink that goes cloudy when you add water, which is known as the ouzo or pastis effect. And the reason it forms is because the oil that gives pernod its aniseed flavour is called transanthiol oil, and it's insoluble in water. So when you add water to pernod, the droplets of oil sort of form and suspend and form this milky solution because it doesn't dissolve. What they found looking at the energy between the water and these droplets is that they will stay stable in this solution even if you add more ethanol, which should technically make these droplets more soluble because they're soluble in alcohol, which is why pernod or ouzo is clear in the bottle.
So what are the things going on?
They don't know. That's the really confusing thing. The emulsion remains stable over a very wide concentration of ethanol and water. And what the team think is that if they can figure out the secret to this sort of super stable pastis emulsion, they'll be able to use it to form nanocapsules to encapsulate drugs for drug delivery, for example, because this is obviously a really energy efficient form of making oil droplets. They form on their own without any additional energy. You'll know that in some emulsions you have to shake them up and add energy to cause this droplet formation, but in pernod and water they form and stay stable over a very wide concentration period.
Well, from one exciting beverage to another, Mark, and that's coffee and a better way to taste it.
Yeah, that's right. One day, machines may be able to wake up and smell the coffee. It's true. Researchers at Nestlé in Lausanne in Switzerland have basically developed a machine that can accurately tell you what a coffee tastes like. Now, for aficionados of coffee, they're often able to discern subtle differences in different types of blends. This complex aroma that comes from coffee is made up of more than 1,000 different volatile compounds. And in fact, most of the taste is in the smell that you get in the air just above the coffee. Now, these researchers have been able to develop a device that can basically sample the gas above a cup and relate the mass spectrometer results of that gas analysis to flavour profiles which have been built up by human experts. So what this group did was to ask experts to classify coffees in 10 different taste categories, such as bitter, woody or acid, things like that. The machine would then go away and with that knowledge compare it with the mass spectrometry results. Now, a mass spectrometer basically takes molecules, chops them up into different pieces to create a sort of fingerprint jigsaw, if you like, that tells you the profile of original compounds that were in the sample. Now, the crucial thing about this machine is that it actually learns from experience. The more coffee it smells, the better it gets at correlating the data that it produces with what human experts have actually described about the aromas.
But there's a lot more to coffee than just the way it smells. When you experience the texture and the overall experience rather than just how it tastes.
That's true, but at some point, and indeed these researchers have reached this point, the aroma is such an important part of the process of experiencing coffee that they've now got this machine to the stage where if they feed the machine with the coffee first, it can accurately predict what the human experts are going to say about the coffee. The machine can predict how the experts are going to rate this on these sorts of flavour categories like bitter or acid. Now, ultimately, the researchers are trying to develop this so that they can basically enable rapid quality control on Nestlé's coffees. The whole process only takes about 2 minutes. I'm sure you've all seen these flavour experts that you see in tea or coffee manufacturers where they're slurping along 100 different cups of tea in an afternoon just to check that all the bags are coming out right. This is a way that it might actually be quicker and just as efficient to do it by machine.
But not half as fun though, I'm sure. Thank you, Mark. Now, thankfully, caffeine isn't very addictive, but morphine and heroin certainly are. And a major street source of these drugs is the opium that's grown in Afghanistan, the sales of which are helping to fund the Taliban. The solution so far has been for the military to attempt to destroy the crops, but they're fighting a losing battle. And now the European think tank, the Senlis Council, is suggesting that farmers could be licensed to grow opium, which would then be bought back from them for pharmaceutical purposes. But the United Nations think that the plan's flawed. From the Senlis Council, here's Paul Burton.
Well, we see within Afghanistan over the last 2 to 3 years an explosion in the growth of poppy. We at the Senlis Council contend that the current policies that are on the table are pretty much proved themselves to be defunct now. We have the option of eradication either by ground-based teams, which is happening to a certain degree in different parts of the south, in Helmand in particular at present.
So when you say they're eradicating things, what's actually going on? How are people seeking to control these poppy growths?
A US private military company called DynCorp has a very good contract from their perspective to actually get in amongst some of the villages and destroy it. They do this on the ground, either by ploughing trucks and SUVs through the fields or, in far more crude measures, by hacking away with scythes at the poppy crop themselves.
Do they employ locals to do this, or do they bring people in from outside to do it?
They're called Mentor, the ANA or the ANP, or some local body to do this.
So where does all that material that gets produced, if it isn't destroyed, end up, and how?
At present, we know that there's a very direct correlation between the burgeoning insurgency and the cash that's generated for that insurgency by the opium crop. There's a very clear link now, as indeed the United Nations itself has demonstrated, between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and whichever way you want to depict the insurgency, their capacity to launch increasingly audacious and higher tempo asymmetric raids against the West, and the capacity of those groups to turn the opium into heroin onward to the European markets, which are now awash with heroin in a way that we haven't seen for many years.
Is that heroin produced on the ground, so to speak, in Afghanistan, or is it moved out of the country as the raw material and then refined elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. Previously, there were fairly large and fairly static labs, usually around the tribal areas abutting Pakistan, that would convert this opium into heroin. We're now seeing a higher prevalence of mobile labs that enable conversion at a more local level within the country.
And so what would the Senlis Council like to see happen instead of external companies going in and driving trucks through people's fields?
Well, the Senlis Council has developed a poppy for medicine project model. It involves licensing the controlled cultivation of poppy to produce essential poppy-based medicine such as morphine, with unlicensed poppy cultivation remaining a criminal activity. Poppy licensing for the production of medicine is actually an alternative counter-narcotic strategy that has been successfully implemented in many countries, Turkey and India in particular.
Now, Dr. Thomas Peachman works for the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. Thomas, do you see this working?
There was a doubling of production between 2005 and 2007. So we are talking now about 8,200 tons of production in Afghanistan in the year 2007.
That's a lot of opium, isn't it?
It's a lot of opium, and there's the problem when you want to use this opium and put it into the illicit circles. It just wouldn't work. You have far too much opium already. The illicit production at the moment has gone down over the last few years simply because there's too much opium on the market. And we have in the year 2006, illicit production of opium and opium equivalents transformed into morphine of a total of 335 tons.
So what you're saying is that the world's already awash with these opiate materials. We don't need any more of them, and therefore the strategy which is being proposed by the Senlis Council isn't going to work, because why should we need any more?
We have huge stocks. We have 2 years of production in stocks at the moment. Countries have had to reduce dramatically the opium production. So we had a decline in the illicit opium production of 65% between 2003 and 2007 in terms of hectares.
So, Paul Burton from the Senlis Council, the world's awash with morphine and we don't need any more.
Well, I mean, that's a standard argument that's put to us. I'd just like to draw upon the stocks issue. And yes, of course, there are significant stocks of raw poppy materials within several countries. The United States, France and Japan, for example, have stocks of around 200 tons between them. However, these stocks do not represent a global oversupply. Stocks appear within the current poppy-based medicine supply system for two reasons. Firstly, the International Narcotics Control Board, which oversees the amount of morphine that each country has, their commodities constitute the raw materials for a range of essential medicines. Consumer countries often build up strategic reserves to cope with future shortage. Secondly, producing countries build stocks to both smooth price trends over time and compete effectively with other producing companies. So typically stocks of agricultural commodities are at levels that we think are sufficient to cover several years of consumption. In comparison, stocks of raw poppies are relatively low because they're managed within the current supply system. The current supply system is deeply flawed. There is, as the World Health Organization has said, an unmet need for morphine. And if you break down the figures, of all the morphine that's in existence in the world at the moment, over 90% of that is used by six countries. So there is a huge unmet need for morphine, particularly in the developing world. We don't seek to convert all of Afghanistan's poppy into opium, but we do seek to convert sufficient quantities to start to address that unmet need in the developing world.
Thomas, that sounds like quite a compelling argument.
The basic argument is right, that you have too little morphine being consumed in the developing countries, and this comes from us, this is our analysis, and again, we agree with our own analysis, and which is also the analysis of the Senlis Council. The problem here is not that there's not sufficient supply over here. There is a problem on the demand side, that you don't have systems in place which allow morphine to get to people who are in need of it. It's not a question, it's not available. It is there. It is waiting, but it's just not being used.
So, Paul, just returning to you finally, it sounds to me like there's a bit of a way to go before the strategy that you are trying to propose could possibly be rolled out.
Sure. And in the interim, what we propose is the introduction of two pilot projects within villages in southern Afghanistan. This would allow us to test all facets of the poppy for medicine idea, from the lowest level capacity of the farmer to turn it into morphine tablets at the local level, up the scale, right up to Kabul, and then onward to the international market. And we have actually established a requirement for morphine from a pilot project within the Brazilian context. So we have an onward market here for this brand of Afghan fair trade morphine, if you like, that we're proposing. There is a critical mass building up within various countries to support pilot projects, and we look to take this forward for the next planting season.
Paul Burton from the Senlis Council and Thomas Peachman, who works at the UNODC. Now, break a leg, as they say, because there's every reason to be enthusiastic about getting better bone repairs in future, Victoria.
Yeah, this research comes out of the UK. One of the researchers is based at University of Southampton, and they've made a polymer that could be a replacement for bone grafts that could heal bone. Bone grafts are surgical procedures that take place when a bone's been so badly damaged that surgeons will take a little bit of bone and put it on to where you need your bone to be repaired so that it can undergo the healing process. But this polymer can replace that very invasive procedure. The tricky thing about it is you need sponge-like polymer that's full of holes, and you need it to be seeded with bone marrow cells and with healing factors and growth factors to promote this healing process. Now, these factors and these cells are extremely delicate physiological chemicals and cells, so the process to make this polymer needs to be very gentle. But to make a sponge-like, very holy polymer often needs very aggressive solvents and high temperatures.
Which would kill those living elements that you
exactly,
mentioned.
Exactly, which would damage those chemicals and damage the cells.
So have they got around the problem?
They have used a solvent under pressure, and the cells seem to tolerate this pressure. But the clever bit of chemistry is the solvent. It's supercritical CO2. Supercritical meaning that it's between being a liquid and a gas. Under pressure, the polymer mixed with the liquid CO2 forms and mixes together, and the cells and chemicals that are needed survive well. And then as the pressure's released, it bubbles up and forms this holy sponge-like polymer.
And presumably the CO2, because the pressure's gone, then evaporates.
Yes, exactly. And this then produces a biodegradable and biocompatible polymer that has no toxic effects. And they've tested it in animals, and it heals well and works fine and biodegrades away. It all works extremely well.
The idea being to unite, say, the two broken ends of a bone so that then you can get growth across using the graft as a sort of scaffolding.
Yeah, using the graft as a scaffolding, but also seeding the graft itself with your own bone marrow cells. So it's sort of a form of tissue engineering as well.
And given that it's worked so successfully in animals, have they given any indication as to when they see trials happening in humans?
That's a big jump, and it's a big clinical trial to be able to undertake, because patients would have to actually undergo surgery. But yeah, that's the next step, to take it clinical.
We're talking about building things, not necessarily out of bone, but out of environmentally friendly things, James. Amazing that BASF have done this with this house.
That's exactly right, Chris. Yes, a house that BASF have just finished up in Nottingham. I went and visited them, and they've used all sorts of clever bits of chemistry to make this house as energy efficient as they can.
I mean, it wouldn't say, looking at the picture, that it's the most exciting looking house. It certainly looks futuristic, but it also looks like a Lego house, forgive me. But what's so special about it?
Funny you should say that it's a Lego house, because the ground floor walls of the house actually are made of polystyrene blocks that slot together exactly like Lego bricks. But around the other side of the house, the south-facing side, it's basically the entire wall is made of glass.
So a massive sun trap, in other words.
Exactly, yes. The whole idea is to get as much energy as possible directly from the sun through passive heating.
And then keep it in by using the fact that you've got this polystyrene, which is a very poor conductor of heat. So once the heat's in, it stays in.
That's right, yes. Yeah. So there's various bits of technology that they've used to keep the heat in. So as well as being polystyrene, these blocks are grey rather than the white of your usual polystyrene coffee cup, because they've got little flecks of graphite in. And what this does is reflects back in heat that's radiating out of the room.
Ingenious. What else have they done?
The roof and upper floor of the house are made from another kind of polymer, polyurethane panels. These are big panels sandwiched between two pieces of wood, so there's very little air transfer. And then any extra bit of heat that needs to be used to top up the house comes from a biomass boiler. So what this boiler uses is locally sourced chips of waste from oilseed rape plants. That sort of tops up the heat. The house also features a ground heat exchanger. So it uses the fact that the ground is always a constant 10 degrees summer or winter. So in the summer, the air is taken through pipes in the ground, and by the time it comes into the house, it's cooled down. But in the winter, it's actually warmed up by the ground.
You seem to have thought of everything. How does this compare with, say, a standard house? If you do the energy calculations, how much better is this?
It's actually a whole lot better. A typical house uses about 200 kilowatt hours per metre square of energy, whereas this house only uses 15. That's only about 7% of the energy use of a typical
house. And in CO2 terms, what would that equate to in terms of emissions you don't make because your house is so much more efficient?
We would produce 7% of the CO2 because it only uses 7% of the energy. This is a step towards the UK government's stated goal that by 2016 all houses will be zero net energy emitting houses.
And taking a look at it, as you have, would you live in it?
I would actually. I think it's a different looking house. People will actually be living in the house in order to sort of test in real conditions just how much energy the house does use. Initially it's going to be students living in the house in order to test in realistic conditions exactly how much energy the house does use, although I think their professors might kick the students out and want to live in it themselves.
Thank you, James. Although I'm not sure of the logic behind testing a supposedly environmentally friendly house on students. Mind you, noise pollution is probably not part of the equation. Now, something that regularly makes headlines is the issue of antibiotic resistance and the rise of superbugs. So I met up with Cambridge University biochemist Peter Ledley to find out how he's trying to tackle the problem.
For a number of years now, we've been asking the question, where do antibiotics come from? I mean, they're natural products, and we know they're produced largely by bacteria in the soil, but we've been using them for 40 years without much clue. And so we've been sequencing genes and trying to understand how these things are made.
In other words, the organisms that naturally make what we call antibiotics or antimicrobials, why they make them in the first place?
It is, if you like, nature's chemistry set. And we believe that they're produced to defend the organism against competition in the soil, which is a very difficult habitat. And particularly for certain bacteria with a complicated life cycle, they actually create food for themselves by part of the colony sacrificing themselves for the greater good. And it's just at that point that they produce the antibiotics.
So the idea is that these would then fend off other things coming in to scrape up the debris and scavenge, so
yes,
the bacteria then don't get any competition.
That's right. And so they would need to make agents that would defend them against both bacteria and fungi.
Does this mean then that pretty much every antimicrobial we are using, we are developing, probably already has a correlate in nature?
Ever since penicillin, the natural world has been plundered for new antimicrobials. It's only in the last 30 years or so that people have tried to make synthetic compounds that would do the same job. And the richest vein for discovery of new drugs is natural products.
How do we go about getting a new kind of antimicrobial from nature's chemistry set?
There are really two approaches now. One is to go back to old antibiotics and try to make new versions of them. That's been very fruitful. You don't have to make very big changes to the chemical structure to overcome the resistance mechanisms that the disease-causing bacteria have evolved. You can do that by chemistry, or, as we've tried to do, you can tinker with the blueprint for the natural antibiotic and make it produce something slightly different.
All right, so you go to the cell, the bacterium or whatever that's making the antimicrobial in the first place, and change what it's using so it produces a slightly modified compound.
Yes.
It sounds quite complicated to do that. Is it not just easier to be good at chemistry and make the molecule in a test tube? Presumably not, or you wouldn't be doing what you're doing.
That's a good point, and medicinal chemistry is very powerful indeed. What usually happens is that the first few hundred analogues are made by semi-synthetic chemistry based on the natural product template. And when that doesn't turn up something that's really effective or better, then you would turn to the sort of approach that we're working with.
So how do you work backwards from, you know that the population of bacteria we're trying to tackle are resistant to compound X, so you want to modify it so they're not. How do you work backwards towards the gene encoding that compound in the bug that originally makes it so that you end up with something that isn't going to be tackled by the bacteria that are resistant?
It is actually rather difficult to do. A few years ago, people were optimistic that you could overwhelm the problem with numbers, and so what people did was to create or amass large libraries of molecules, maybe 400,000 chemicals, and rapidly sort through them using robots. and design screens that would exactly filter out those that would meet the requirements. And that would be based on an understanding of how the disease-causing bacteria actually become resistant. Perhaps they pump out your precious drug or they protect the target. And so you would design an assay to look for chemicals that would overcome that. But that random approach hasn't, I'm afraid, been very fruitful. So what we do now is start with a drug that used to be efficient and just make small changes and hope for the best.
So it's still a sort of going in with a sledgehammer and seeing what you can get out of it, I suppose.
It's hit and miss.
Now, the big problem is that bacteria change and we put them under selective pressure when we chuck drugs at them and they become resistant. Are there any targets that we could aim at in bacteria that are less likely to end up with a rapid evolution of resistance among those bacteria? Are there hot spots that we could go for?
Most people agree that if you tackle a weak point in the metabolism of a bacterium where, in order to acquire resistance, it would have to change multiple genes, that would be a way of slowing up resistance. And it's certainly true that one of the most famous drugs that is the last line of resistance, vancomycin, targets cell wall biosynthesis. And it took 40 years for resistance to vancomycin to emerge. Another thing I think we can do is use combinations. After all, we use those types of drugs in cancer therapy with great success.
So as someone who makes these agents, are you yourself worried at the moment, given the situation we find ourselves in the average UK hospital with the resistance rate?
We should be concerned, but we shouldn't be panicking. We need good hygiene practices. We need not to overprescribe. We need to have new agents brought forward that are perhaps more selective. And we need to make people aware of the potential risks. But I certainly don't think that Armageddon is just round the corner.
Cambridge University's Peter Ledley, who's developing novel classes of antibiotics to tackle the rising tide of resistant bacteria. One of the techniques Peter mentioned was dipping into the genomes of organisms to find out how they make antibiotic compounds. Well, now it sounds like the job of DNA and RNA sequencing could be about to become a whole lot simpler, Mark.
That's right. Everybody's familiar with the idea of DNA fingerprinting, where you take a small sample of DNA and use a reaction called the polymerase chain reaction to increase the number of DNA molecules, amplifying the amount so that it's easier to analyse those bases which make up the chemical information in DNA in the laboratory. But this is quite a long process. It requires a lot of chemical processing. And, of course, you need a laboratory to do it. So researchers working at the Institute for Analytical Sciences in Dortmund in Germany have found a way to read the code directly. And what they're doing is one base at a time, being able to identify those bits of chemical information that are stuck onto the backbone of RNA, which is DNA's chemical cousin.
So how do they do the actual reading?
Well, this is the amazing bit. They use a combination of two different techniques. One of them is called atomic force microscopy, and the other one is Raman spectroscopy. Atomic force microscopy is basically like having a very small record player arm. So the tip of the record player arm in atomic force microscopy moves across the surface of a molecule, jiggling up and down as it goes. This AFM tip is combined with a laser in the Raman spectroscopy system, which basically looks at each of the bases as the tip moves along the molecule of RNA in order to do a chemical analysis on it. What the Raman spectrometer reads is a characteristic fingerprint caused by the absorption of that laser light.
So why do you actually need both techniques? Why do you need the AFM and the Raman spectroscope going? Why can't you just read the RNA with the AFM?
Yeah, this is the thing. You need both because certainly when you're using Raman spectroscopy, you'd be able to look at the molecule and the laser light wouldn't be able to be focused to one particular area on the molecule. It might be looking at a very large area indeed. The point with the AFM is that even though the tip isn't the same size as the bases, the tip can be moved one base at a time, that small sort of 2/1,000,000,000 of a metre that you need to move it in order to move the laser along the sample very precisely one step at a time. And basically the spectrum that they get out, it's probably still going to be looking at maybe half a dozen bases at once. But the fact that you can move it along one base at a time means that by comparison with the neighbouring one that you just took, you can see what the difference is and thus work out what the next base along the chain is.
And hence what the chemical signal is that's there. Where do they see this being employed?
Well, this is the thing. This is very much a proof of principle experiment to show that you can even do this. They hope that in the future, when we spoke to Volker Deckert, who's one of the key people behind this, he said that one day he hoped it would be as easy to analyse DNA as reading a barcode at the supermarket. Now, that's a long way away, but ultimately this is the sort of thing where you could analyse much smaller samples of DNA and potentially do it in a much more portable way. You wouldn't necessarily need to rely on a laboratory to do the analysis.
Thanks, Mark. And sticking with things that are very, very small, James, nanowire clothing.
Yep, that's right, Chris. Your iPod could one day be powered by your trousers if researchers in the US manage to develop their technique a little bit further.
How does this work?
Well, what they've done is they've developed a yarn that generates electricity simply by being bent or twisted. So they've exploited what are called piezoelectric properties of zinc oxide. So it's literally when these crystals get bent or twisted, they generate a current, a very small current. But if you have enough of these, then you could potentially get enough power to run something like a mobile phone or an iPod.
It doesn't sound like easy listening, though, James. You've got to be continually jiggling around to power the damn thing.
Well, that's true, but I suppose that you could connect your trousers up to a battery and save the power for later on if you wanted to sit still and listen.
And if you wear shorts, presumably you can't listen to as much music.
Well, I suppose a nanowire top would have to do instead.
But seriously, how much energy can it generate, this fabric?
They think that they'd be able to get out 80 milliwatts of electrical power per square metre of fabric. That's quite a step up from what they've got so far. They've basically just got a small section of, I think it's 6 threads, just to test the principle. So what they've done is used Kevlar fibres and dipped it into a zinc oxide solution. And so off that fibre grow other little fibres, so it looks almost like a tiny bottle brush. So that's one half of the molecule, or one half of the fabric, I should say. The other half is gold fibres made in the same sort of way. So when these two fibres rub against each other when you're moving around, the friction causes the zinc oxide to sort of generate this power, and the gold captures that power, so you could potentially connect that up to a circuit.
I like the sound of that. Thanks, James. Now, from pant-powered iPods to this month's chemical conundrum and some science whose history goes back over 100 years, Victoria.
Yep, that's right, Chris. We wanted to know what makes safety matches safe. There's a clever bit of chemistry involved, and so we wanted to find out.
And the answer is that the heads of safety matches are made of antimony sulfide, which is the fuel in the match, and potassium chlorate, which is the oxidizer in the match. Now, on the matchbox itself, you have red phosphorus and powdered glass. So what happens is that when you strike the match against the matchbox, some of the red phosphorus is converted into white phosphorus. It's just a different arrangement of the phosphorus atoms. Now, white phosphorus ignites spontaneously in air. Now, that triggers the potassium chlorate to start releasing some oxygen. That, in turn, starts the antimony sulfide burning, which then ends up making the wood of the match burn. Now, the safety bit is that they've separated these components out, the phosphorus and the oxidizer, the potassium chlorate, into different parts. Once upon a time, matches had all of those things all embroiled together in the same match head, which made them very prone to going off when you least expected them.
So what we were looking for was that key fact that some of the flammable ingredients are separated out onto the matchbox instead, making the matches safe. And thank you very much to our four lucky winners, Nick Lackin, Alan Farrell, Henry Day and Thomas Bird, who will all be receiving Chemistry World goodie bags.
Go on, Vic. Can you tell us what's in the fabled Chemistry World goodie bag?
A chemistry Sudoku book, a chemistry crossword book, of course, a much requested copy of Chemistry World, some RSC temperature reactive pens, which I think are quite fun.
So what do we have to do next month to win one?
Next month's question is a little simpler. We want to know, what is the pigment that makes daffodils yellow? A bit of a spring-themed question for our listeners. So if you know the answer, then please send us an email with your name and address and send that to chemistryworld at rsc.org.
And you can also use that address if you'd like to send us some feedback or suggestions for the programme. This month's edition was brought to you by Chemistry World's editor Mark Peplow and science correspondents Victoria Gill and James Mitchell Crowe. This is a NakedScientists.com production by Mira Synthalingam, and I'm Chris Smith. Until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.